President, and let me begin by commending you and this group for the serious engagement and the insight and sophistication of the questions and comments. Even at this first session of your working group, it's very reassuring to see the creativity and the energy and the dedication that you are showing, that you're bringing to this question. And I must say, as an observer, it gives me great confidence, great reason to be hopeful that this group really will be able to fulfill the expectations of the General Assembly in making a real contribution to the growth of international law and principles on the safeguarding of outer space. And let me begin by responding to several of the comments by reminding the group that in principle, there are two different complementary methods for expanding international law and principles on the safety of outer space. One method is by creative interpretation and expansive elaboration of existing materials, taking the texts and the principles that are familiar and applying them in new and creative ways to new circumstances. The other method is to legislate new principles and law. And I just want to remind the group that both of those methods are important. They can be used in a complementary fashion, and this group, I think, could make useful contributions in both those ways. Much of the discussion today has been on the expansive use of existing terms in the Outer Space Treaty, in other parts of international law, using familiar existing principles in new and better ways. And I support that, but I also support the idea that international law has gotten stuck in outer space, that we have not seen new contributions of positive international legally binding materials in recent decades. And I think that's a problem that should be redressed in the near future as well. Turning to the specific questions on my presentations from the delegation from Brazil and others, let me begin by acknowledging that there are many ways in which inherently dual use capabilities cannot be feasibly separated. GPS is a good example of that, where the same satellite is used simultaneously for multiple civilian and military purposes, and it would no longer be feasible to require separation of that. But there are some circumstances where feasibility, where separation would be feasible, where it would be possible. Even though it is not always done today, it would be feasible to separate. And remember, the law of armed conflict here does not have a category called dual use or dual capable objects. Under the law of armed conflict, everything is either a civilian object or a military objective. And if something is in fact used for both, then it's location, nature, purpose, and use makes it a military objective subject to targeting. For me, the classic case of a violation of the principle of reverse distinction would be a satellite, a bus, that houses both a military component and a civilian component, where there are two transponders or two sensors that are used, one for military purposes and another for civilian purposes, and they are contained in the same satellite. To me, that's a choice. That's an option where the country has decided we're going to save some money, perhaps, by putting those two different functions on the same satellite. And that's exactly what I think the law of armed conflict was designed to prevent, was to require those to be separated if it is feasible to do so. In GPS, it's not feasible. In many other settings, I think it would be. But it's also the case, as several of you have noted, that identifying something as a military objective is not the end of the legal analysis. The next step is proportionality. And if one is attacking or preparing to attack a military objective, one must also assess the unintended but foreseeable collateral harm to civilian objects and civilian persons. And if it is determined that there is a disproportionality between the expected military gain and the anticipated civilian losses, then the attack cannot be done in that way at that time, must be altered so that the military gain would be proportionate to the civilian harm. And so proportionality is absolutely the next step in the legal analysis. Identifying something as a military objective is the first step, but not the only one. And let me close by making one other point that we haven't paid enough attention to today, and that is that the Outer Space Treaty creates an unusual international law rule regarding private commercial activities. Under traditional international law, in most other venues, a state is not responsible for the actions of its nationals. If you are harmed by a person or a corporation from a foreign country, you have a cause of action against that person or corporation, but not ordinarily against the state with which that person or corporation is associated. That's a separate legal authority, and the state is not responsible for the bad actions of its nationals. Article 6 of the Outer Space Treaty creates a different rule for outer space and says that a country is responsible for the space actions of its nationals. That different rule means that in outer space, the actions of private corporations are attributable to the state of their nationality. And it's sometimes complicated to determine which state or states are responsible, but it does expand the legal obligations for peaceful uses of outer space beyond just state actors to private actors as well. I'll stop there. Thank you.